people. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said in chapter Nisa, verse 94, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم يا أيها الذين آمنوا إذا ضربتم في سبيل الله فتبينوا. O you who have faith, when you issue forth in the way of Allah, try to ascertain. ولا تقولوا لمن ألقى إليكم السلام لست مؤمنا. Do not say to someone who offers you peace or claims that I'm a Muslim, you are not a Muslim, you are not a believer. تبتغون عرض الحياة الدنيا. Seeking the transitory words of the life of this world. Now, according to this verse, if any person claims that I'm a Muslim, am I able to act upon inquisition to go through his beliefs? Are you really a Muslim? Mm-hmm. No. The verse is explicit in this regard. Regarding the occasion of the revelation, as we mentioned, that some of the companions of the prophet met a group of people from a certain tribe. That person said Salamun Alaikum, which was a kind of the fact that he believed in the religion of Islam. But those companions thought that he is just saying that in order for him to save his life. And that is why, unfortunately, they killed him and they took his sheep as a kind of a booty.
That's right.
Later, the Holy Prophet came to know about that. He became very upset. And the verse was revealed to him to tell the Muslims that you have no right to do that. If a person claims that he is a Muslim, then he or she is a Muslim, and you cannot do inquisition.
That's right.
On the other hand, according to the religion of Islam, we have no right to insult other people because of their beliefs.
That's right.
Islam is very clear in this regard. Even we are not allowed to insult the idols.
Yes.
To that extent, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that as Muslims, you have no right to insult those who are worshipped by the polytheists. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in chapter An'am, verse 108, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم ولا تسبوا الذين يدعون من دون الله. Do not abuse those whom they invoke beside Allah, meaning the idols,
that's
or whatever.
فَيَسُبُّ
اللَّهَ عَدْمًا بِغَيْرِ عِلْمٍ Lest they should abuse Allah out of hostility without any knowledge. And this is a good lesson for many Muslims nowadays that unfortunately we have it, unfortunately some minorities among both Shia and Sunni who try to insult the sacred personalities of the other group, for example. The verse is very clear that you have no right to do sab. To insult, to abuse, to use foul language.
Yes,
we may analyze the history. We may refer to the historical events, but we have no right in insulting others in terms of beliefs.
And since we know that, for example, in the past, inside maybe Christianity, which is even criticized by them themselves, for example, the clashes that was between the Catholic and Protestant churches, you know, bringing the skulls into the church and doing inquisitions, and even the forceful, we can say, conversion of some of the Muslims into Christianity or Jews into Christianity, these are all the we can say the dark parts of the religion, which was misunderstood by the people who were in charge of the religion. And this is, as you said, absolutely wrong in the religion of Islam too. Inside the religion of Islam, the hardliners, the extremists, are also always criticized for such a look at the religion of Islam. We cannot force someone to, for example, convert to Islam or kill him or excommunicate him from within the religion of Islam. All of these are banned in the religion of Islam, as you said.
Yeah, unfortunately, as you rightly mentioned, this forceful conversion, we have it in the history of humankind.
Yes.
It's not, and unfortunately, in some parts of the Islamic world, we have seen that we have forced conversion from Christianity to Islam as well, but this is not based in line with the Islamic teachings.
But from the other side, we have the concept of tabligh, dissemination of thoughts or preaching Islam. What is this part?
Yeah, these two are absolutely different. When it comes to tabligh or disseminating and preaching the religion of Islam, when we say that we have no right to insult the other beliefs, it doesn't mean that we believe in the truth of other religions. For sure, as Muslims, we believe that nowadays the only truth, the only religion with truth is the religion of Islam. Other Abrahamic religions, they have some share of the truth, but not, but they have some distortions as well.
Yes.
Polytheism is absolutely rejected according to the religion of Islam. So, from one side, we do not believe in inquisition, we do not believe in insulting others because of their beliefs, but on the other side, because of the fact that we know that the way that they are following is not the true path. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we are not allowed to force anyone to change his or her beliefs. But doesn't mean that we have no right to preach our religion? Of mm-hmm. course not.
Okay.
We have absolute right to talk about the doctrines and teachings of the religion of Islam so that people come to know about this religion.
That's right.
And then the decision is left to them.
Yes.
It is up to them.
Okay.
This is what we call it the freedom of thought and freedom in choosing the religion, which
yes.
is one of the fundamentals of the religion of Islam.
That's right.
In chapter Tawbah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in verse 6, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وَإِنْ أَحَدٌ مِنَ الْمُشْرِكِينَ اسْتَجَارَكَ فَأَجِرْهُ حَتَّى يَسْمَعَ كَلَامَ اللَّهِ This is a very interesting verse. O Prophet, if any of the polytheists seeks asylum from you, grant him asylum until he hears the word of Allah.
Yes.
Imagine there is a polytheist, he doesn't know about the religion of Islam. He wants to come to the Prophet to hear about the religion mm-hmm. of Islam. Allah says that give him asylum. ثُمَّ أَبْلِغُ مَأْمَنَا Then convey him to his place of safety. So Allah doesn't say that then he needs to accept the religion of Islam. No. He comes to you to know about the religion of Islam. You tell them the reality of the religion of Islam. Then even convey him to his place of safety.
That's right.
Which means that whether he believes in Islam or not, he is absolutely safe. You have
right.
no right to harm him.
Okay.
Again, in chapter... So the point is that we believe that faith, iman, Islam is a matter of heart. Mm-hmm. You cannot force any person to believe in the religion of Islam. Otherwise, Allah subhanahu wa
yes.
ta'ala himself would have forced the people to believe in the religion of Islam.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, inshallah,
inshallah, you'll find your way. And we know that it was for the love and the affection inside the Islam that so many people on the early Islam from different religions converted into the religion of mm-hmm. Islam. Salman al-Farsi, Ruzbeh from Isfahan, you know, passed all the way from Great Persia into Arab Peninsula, you know, that's all right. Bilal Habashi from Abyssinia, you know, he also traveled. At the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, so many non-Muslims who converted to Islam because of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and joined his army, they were martyred, you know. And all these people, you know, understood, as you said, the truth of faith, iman, inside the religion of Islam. And then we can say this is the best preaching for Islam, you know, kind
yeah.
of language.
Regarding the fact that Islam does not believe in forcing other people into mm-hmm. converting to the religion of Islam, we have the famous story of Mubahala.
Mm-hmm.
And in that story, we know that
yes.
the Prophet Muhammad has established a government. And the Christians of Najran come to the Prophet and they have a dispute and discussion with the Prophet. They bring their evidence and proofs. The Holy Prophet also brings his evidence, and they are not convinced. What is the result? Does the Holy Prophet force them that you need to believe in the religion of Islam because this is Islamic government and you're living in the under this Islamic territory? No. They do not believe, and then they agree on taking part in Mubahala, in mutual cursing, and then again they agree to, not to take part in the Mubahala, the Holy Prophet accept, and then again they ask the Prophet to just pay jizya like other Ahlul Kitab
yes.
and continue to live as Christians.
That's all right.
So this is the reality of the religion of Islam. There is no inquisition, there is no forcing into conversion to the religion of Islam.
That's all right.
Let's go to the time of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. There are
yes.
many stories about him having debates with atheists. And hardly we find any historical record to tell us that they have converted to the religion of Islam after this discussion with the Prophet, with Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Of course, there are some exceptions, but they remain atheists, which means that the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt also believed in the concept of preaching Islam, even to have free discussion with atheists, but without insulting, without forcing any person to believe in the religion of Islam. So Inquisition is absolutely different from preaching.
Yes.
We do believe in the concept of preaching, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, فَبَشِّرْ عِبَادِ give good news to my servants, الَّذِينَ يَسْتَمِعُونَ الْقَوْلِ فَيَتَّبِعُونَ أَحْسَنَهُ those right. who listen to the word of Allah, those who listen to the word and follow the best. Mm-hmm. So this is the message of Islam.
That's all right.
Any person needs to listen to different words, meaning to go and search for the truth, and then when he or she finds the truth, just to follow it.
That's all right.
Different people might come to different conclusions, and Islam respects that.
Okay.
And that is why Islam does not force anyone to convert to the religion of Islam.
But I think the best type of tabligh was done by the Ahlul Bayt themselves, especially the high knowledge that they had of the other religions, previous religions. And this is, I think, the best lesson and example for those preachers, for those muballiqeen and the muballiqas who are sent all across the world in order to preach Islam. I mean, the Ahlul Bayt are the best role models, how high knowledge they had of the religions to give proper, authentic answers to the doubts and questions that are posed.
That's one point. And the second point, which might be more important, is your mannerism, which is emphasized a lot in the narrations. Most of the people, they have converted to the religion of Islam through seeing the good manners of Muslims and not through a scholarly discussion. And the last verse that I would like to share is verse 256 of chapter Baqarah. La ikraha fi ad-din. There is no compulsion in religion. But does it mean that you have no right to preach? No. Then the verse reads, قَدْ تَبَيَّنَ الرُّشْدُ مِنَ الْغَيْرِ Rectitude has become distinct from error. And one of the duties of Muslims is to preach and tell the people about this rushd or rectitude and leave the decisions to the people.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi, for a nice elaboration. It was very kind of you regarding the difference between inquisition and tabligh or preaching inside the religion of Islam. And thank you much to the listeners for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en, call of Islam page. The another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanillah. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
يوسف جلالي بتهران
روباشافت غازا
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
After 1 year under the Taliban control, Afghanistan is on the brink of economic collapse. This is according to the latest update by the World Food Programme. the UN body says the economic crisis wiped out jobs, salaries, and livelihoods across Afghanistan, limiting people's purchasing power. The WFP has called on the international community to step up its efforts before winter to avert a humanitarian catastrophe.
Today, I came to the bazaar to buy some food. As I checked the prices and the money in my pocket, I couldn't afford a sack of rice. I'm sure others are facing the same situation. We call on the Taliban and the international community to take steps towards fixing Afghanistan's worsening economy.
Here on a Kabul street, Afghans sell household items to escape poverty and keep food on the plate. These people say it's a matter of survival for them. They are also concerned about their future.
We are just trying to survive in this difficult economic situation. We are forced to sell our belongings and household items to put bread on the table. Some are selling second-hand items to pay their debt and bills, since they have been unemployed for months. I don't know what I will do in the coming month to make ends meet.
The Taliban Deputy Economy Minister blamed the economic crisis on 2 decades of U.S. occupation and Washington sanctions on the war-ravaged country.
Today's deteriorating economic situation in our country is a legacy of the U.S. invasion, because the U.S. never let Afghan national economic bodies grow or become self-sufficient. All the U.S. did was to keep Afghanistan a consumer country and dependent on U.S. aid. Likewise, after the withdrawal, the U.S. seized Afghanistan's assets and cut international funding. As a result, the U.S. is to blame for Afghanistan's fragile economy.
In the meantime, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs has announced that 25 million people in Afghanistan are living in poverty, and 19 million people are facing food insecurity. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres arrived in Pakistan to see climate-induced devastation from months of deadly record floods that have left 500,000 people living in tents under the open sky and have left nearly 1,400 deaths. During his visit, the UN chief and Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif discussed the latest situation in the country. The two focused on joint efforts to carry out relief, rescue, and rehabilitation at the international level to mitigate the sufferings of the flood-affected people. Later, the visiting UN chief also met Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari and assured him of every support possible. The UN Secretary General, who has launched a global appeal to raise $160 million in flood assistance for Pakistan, says Pakistan is one of the countries most affected by climate change in recent months.
Developed countries must step up and provide Pakistan and other countries on the front lines with the financial and technical resources they need to survive extreme weather events like these deadly floods.
Bhutto said that his government is trying its best to help people who had lost everything in floods, but international help would be required to overcome the catastrophe.
I cannot shelter 33 million families. I cannot provide the food and clothing for 35 million families. We don't have the infrastructure in place. And this is just the rescue and relief phase.
The UN chief will travel to areas most impacted by the climate catastrophe. He will interact with the displaced families and oversee the UN's humanitarian response and relief efforts for millions of affected people. As the floods continue to ravage Pakistan, UN agencies and several countries continue to send aid to flood-affected people in recent weeks. However, Pakistani authorities believe that more assistance is required to help millions of flood victims. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Mm-hmm.
The annual report from one of France's top NGOs revealed that poverty has already skyrocketed this year. And that's at what many say is only the beginning of years of inflation and recession provoked by sanctions on Russia over the unrest in Ukraine. Secours Populaire found that the number of people who say they have known poverty has increased 9% in just the past year. That's the biggest increase in 30 years. This year, over 40% of France says they can't pay their transport, medical, energy, or childcare bills, or go on vacation, or even buy fruits and vegetables. It's the highest percentage they've ever recorded.
The poverty question in France is one that's been central, but the social safety net is running out. It's just going to get worse and worse for the poor people, because they're not going to be able to afford this stuff, you know? And the French are not going to be able to subsidize these cost of living increases the way they did.
The steep increase in poverty comes after a decade of failed austerity policies and a deep devaluing of the euro currency. The government just announced they expect the next two economic quarters to produce a growth rate of 0.2% and then 0%. Many predict that the essentially recession-level economy will soon begin massive layoffs. That combination spells stagflation, and it's something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy. This adds to the feeling of unease, especially among the investor class and high finance.
France has a pretty good record of having a social safety net for those who are on bottom as far as health care is concerned and other basic necessities. But since Macron got elected, a lot of those things have changed because Macron has decided that he's going to attack that social safety net.
The report showed that a near universal 85% of France is worried for the future generations. That's also the highest percentage ever recorded. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A rally has been held in the besieged Gaza Strip to show support for Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds against the growing Israeli aggressions. Protesters have chanted slogans against the Israeli regime and called for an end to the Israeli occupation. Tensions have soared in Al-Quds in recent weeks as extremist Israeli settlers backed by Israeli forces desecrated Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned the Israeli regime against committing violations in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque will not be tolerated by the Palestinian people. Our people will defend Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque with all means. Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line that must not be crossed.
People have come out to reiterate their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against the Israeli attacks. Al-Quds is a holy region of significant importance for all Muslims around the world.
Palestinian resistance groups will defend Al-Quds and will always be a safety valve to protect our people. Armed resistance is the key to the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine.
Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
This protest is sending a strong message to the whole world that Gaza will not sit idly while Al-Quds is being desecrated. Al-Quds is the eternal capital of Palestine. We also want to condemn the daily killing of our people in the occupied West Bank by Israeli forces and the construction of illegal settlements as well as home demolitions.
Since the Israeli occupation of Al-Quds in 1967, the city and Al-Aqsa Mosque have been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice.
Palestinians in the blockaded coastal territory say that they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Britain has a new monarch. King Charles III used his first address to the nation since taking the throne to pay tribute to his late mother.
Queen Elizabeth was a life well lived, a promise with destiny kept, and she is mourned most deeply in her passing. That promise of lifelong service I renew to you all today.
Earlier, the new king, alongside Queen Consort Camilla, met well wishers gathered outside Buckingham Palace, paying their respects after the passing of Queen Elizabeth II on Thursday. Gun salutes, floral tributes, and flags flying at half-mast symbolize the country in the first phase of an official 12-day mourning period. Messages of condolences flooded in from world leaders, with domestic tributes being led in the House of Commons by the new Prime Minister, Liz Truss.
Today, we show the world that we do not fear what lies ahead. We send our deepest sympathy to all members of the royal family. We pay tribute to our late Queen, and we offer loyal service to our new King.
These are unprecedented times, and the parliamentarians will be getting used to saying God save the King instead of God save the Queen. But what will a monarchy under the stewardship of Charles III really look like? Charles's ascension to the throne comes following a 7-decade-long reign by the late monarch.
Lots of people who maybe were not great fans of the monarchy as an institution respected Queen Elizabeth II for her longevity, for her record. They forgot many of the things that she was also associated with, the end of empire, which is often very brutal in places like Kenya. But they gave her some respect, and you'll see that, I think, over the next 12 days. You'll see people prepared to give that respect to the Queen. I think it's going to be a very different story going down the road, and we should remember that the monarchy is very important to the British elite. The armed forces, the security services, judiciary, they swear loyalty not to Parliament, but to the monarchy.
Charles's new role as king comes at not just a tumultuous time for the throne, but for the country itself.
If he's going to be an effective king, he will have to speak to the nation in a way that brings people together. And that may involve him, and as Charles has known to do this in the past, be a very much more politically, overly political monarch than some of his predecessors. He's made interventions on various issues, and I think he'll continue to do that going forward.
At home and abroad, there are questions about what Britain's new monarch's vision will be. Will the tentacles of the new reign bring forth a new dawn? Former subjects across the world will simply wait and see. Amina Taylor, London.
A shroud of terror has descended onto the streets of Leicester, with Muslim residents of the English town living in fear for their very safety. Racism, cricket hooliganism, and violent street assaults, all targeting Muslims of mostly Pakistani origin, has become commonplace in this once peaceful city. Amid the hate crime spike, Press TV was informed by concerned locals that the attacks appear to be conducted by Hindu thugs radicalized by foreign extremism.
At this stage, we cannot verify the political affiliations of the perpetrators. However, speaking to local Muslim residents, they've expressed major concerns that what might be inspiring this latest round of attacks could be Hindutva supremacism from India. The rise of anti-Muslim violence taking place over there could have a ripple effect affecting the Indian diaspora community, particularly here in the UK, which boasts a sizable British Indian community.
Hindutva has become a significant ideology inside India, seeking to establish Hindu hegemony over the country. Many of its advocates preach intolerance towards rival religious groups, especially Muslims, who've become a prime target of India's Hindu extremist rhetoric. Local activists informed us that they believe it's the same Hindutva hate which has caused the rise in Islamophobia here in Britain.
The Muslims and the Hindus in Leicester have been getting along for decades. We've not had no issues. It's these latest crowds of these young Hindutva ideology thugs, RSS, the BJP thugs, this mentality, they come with this mentality, they're trying to bring it down here, and they're very, very racist, and they're the ones who are causing the problems in the community.
This year, at least 3 severe attacks have occurred, with at least 2 victims being hospitalized. The media has so far only focused on a recent outpouring of anger by local Muslims, venting their frustrations via scuffles with the police on Monday night. But if the alleged problem of Hindu radicalism isn't dealt with soon, Muslim vigilantism may become the go-to option for some furious locals. Robert Carter, Leicester.
It's been dubbed the most right-wing cabinet for a generation. Formed after new PM Liz Truss's fulsome support for her predecessor and a purge of defeated rival Rishi Sunak loyalists. Some of the familiar faces, Kwasi Kwarteng, a free marketeer and Truss's ideological soulmate, confirmed as chancellor. Ex-leadership candidate Suela's Braverman, admired by the right wing for attacks on, quote, woke politics, appointed home secretary. Staunch ally James Cleverly, promoted as foreign minister. On his entree, Ukraine and fixing relations with the EU, strained after Brexit, among other things. Close friend Teresa Coffey will be deputy prime minister and health secretary. The National Health Service is reeling under a staff and cash crisis. And another carryover from the Johnson administration, Jacob Rees-Mogg, the man who blamed the energy crisis in the UK on climate alarmists, will be business and energy secretary.
What we therefore have is a very clearly defined agenda with Liz Truss surrounding herself by people she thinks will be loyal to her and will share some quite central policy objectives, which I'd suggest are sharper than those of her predecessor.
The makeup of the Truss team goes against her pledge to use what she called all the fantastic talents of the Conservative Party.
Liz Truss won less than 60% of the Conservative Party membership vote, and when she threw her hat in the ring for party leadership, she won fewer than a third of the Conservative MPs' votes, which means that she could have done herself a favor by trying to appeal to as wide a base of parliamentary support as possible.
Especially because she will need her party's support for her plans for her three priorities, the economy, energy, and the NHS.
So they might grumble in private, but they'll show the impression of unity in public. The biggest issue, though, for her is that if she does controversial things in legislative terms, which MPs think aren't going to work, then she could have problems.
The 56th UK Prime Minister takes up the reins of power as the UK toils under spiralling levels of inflation, skyrocketing energy costs, an economy almost certainly in recession, and public services on the brink. It remains to be seen if she and her cabinet can deliver on her promises. Saeed Bourizab, London.
The Seoul Defense Dialogue Security Forum addressed the North Korea issue Wednesday as leading military strategists grappled for a coherent policy toward Pyongyang. In South Korea, President Yoon Suk-yeol's hard line involves strengthening the U.S. alliance and bolstering military capabilities, including a potential preemptive strike.
Kill chain will pre-detect North Korea's nuclear missile launch and be able to interfere with it, blocking any incoming nuclear attacks. And in order to prevent the worst case, we are intensively organizing the defense budget and developing military strategies to prepare a military retaliation.
President Yoon promised to normalize operations of the U.S. anti-ballistic missile system, THAAD, which was deployed in 2017, with new equipment brought in late Sunday night in an attempt to foil local protesters. Yoon has said he would like to deploy more THAAD missile batteries. At the forum, President Yoon's hard line was echoed by Japan.
There could be a lot of sanctions that would be imposed together with other countries, and there could be certain measures which some countries can do unilaterally, and it's a kind of a combination, but we have to share the same goal of urging North Korea to accept the terms. We have to figure out where it hurts most for the North Koreans.
Several forum speakers stressed coordinated sanctions, which have so far failed, yet offered few alternatives. Settling the issue of North Korea's nuclear and missile programs and ending sanctions against Pyongyang will require bringing North Korea to the negotiating table. But so far, the U.S. and its allies, South Korea and Japan, appear unwilling to provide much incentive for North Korea to re-enter talks. Also on Wednesday, the nuclear envoys of the U.S., South Korea and Japan met in Tokyo to coordinate strategies seeking to denuclearize North Korea. The U.S. repeated its offer to meet unconditionally with North Korea, while U.S.-led unilateral and U.N. Security Council sanctions remain in place. Frank Smith, Seoul.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight.
China is engaged in efforts to facilitate trade via the use of its national currency, and that's a good sign for the crowning of US dollar in the near future. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International Roads, Russia's energy giant Gazprom agreed with China to conduct trade in yuan and rubles instead of the US dollar. It was reported on September 6th. The news once again intensified debate about whether the yuan will replace the dollar as the dominant global currency. While many economic analysts argue against such a possibility, this narrative is largely irrelevant. The Western narrative dismissing yuan from becoming the global currency is often based on default pro-Western cultural, political, and economic biases. Prior to addressing the yuan versus the dollar argument, it is important to be clear that the process of dollar's diminishing role as the global currency will take time. While the yuan is in the process of decreasing the dollar's dominance, it is not in a position to replace it yet. In fact, in the new emerging multipolar world order, it is highly unlikely that a single currency will dominate global transactions. The reason is simple. Currency domination is linked to political and military power. The US dollar emerged in a dominant role because of America's political and military expansionism. It had little or nothing to do with Washington's economic policies. China's prominence is primarily due to its economic performance, not military or political expansionism. Those who dismiss yuan in favor of the US dollar often bring up the term belief in the US economy. The dollar is backed by a belief in American global hegemony, which, according to many experts, is decreasing. It should also be noted that yuan is a relatively new currency. Until about 25 years ago, China's economy was not so strong. It was considered a third world country, albeit with a huge population that was seen as a drag on its economic growth. Today, China is an economic giant on the global stage. Its economic terms, yuan is a beginner, but because it is a currency of an economy with a massive manufacturing capability, there is something tangible behind the notion of Chinese economics. Thus, just like people believe in US economy, people have sound economic reasons to trust and believe in yuan as well. China is a leading trading hub for the world people. This automatically creates demand for its currency as well. It may soon evolve into a desire by people worldwide to have some yuans as well as insurance. Debate on the future of the US dollar should not be focused on the replacement aspect, but on how much prominence other currencies will gain in global trade. The NATO regime's economic war on Russia following its operation in Ukraine has once again demonstrated to many developing countries that these countries will not hesitate to weaponize many economic aspects of the current international relations system. This understanding has created a demand and a desire not to be dependent on one economic system or its currency. Asia Times also wrote, 2 years ago this month, China's Xi Jinping and Russia's Vladimir Putin agreed to a financial alliance. It won little attention at the time. The pact to reduce their economy's dependence on the dollar seemed more aspirational, more rhetorical than tangible until now. As economist Ivan Teshakrov at Citigroup reports, yuan trading at the Moscow Exchange, Russia's largest, has surged more than 40-fold this year. What's more, he notes yuan dealing has now started to dominate trading in more traditional currencies. This is happening against the backdrop of fast declining trading in the US dollar. It would be intellectually dishonest to argue things unfolded exactly as Xi and Putin expected in August 2020.
Start. Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. This is Arab English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is Bita at your service.
Very happy to meet you here, Bita.
A nice pleasure.
Okay, so, this is Youth Station. We're having another episode.
Yeah, it is IRIB English Radio, and
yes,
we are at your service. It's a big pleasure. We're going to have a nice discussion together.
Before we forget the main thing, well, this is Asma. Hope you do not forget my name.
Yeah, my sister Asma. So today we're going to have a hot topic, I think, because we're going to talk about mind and brain conflict, you know, and between this conflict between heart and, you know, for example, there are some times in your life that, for example, your mind can see something, but your heart isn't, for example, consider and recognize that thing, you know. And first of all, I want to start with a point. Most of the time, people think that there is an opposition between these two. I mean, they think like, okay, for example, if something
So we're going through a scientific discussion.
Yeah, exactly. Not that much scientific. I think psychologic more than scientific. And they think like, okay, we're going to talk about the opposition between these two. That, for example, when your heart wants something, exactly that thing is not true.
The heart and the mind.
Yeah, exactly. But today, I'm going to just tell you that this is not about a position. It's about distinction between two of these things.
Now, well, I would say it's about opposition.
Okay.
Yes,
it is. I do not agree with you. Because it's not like that, you know. When you say a position, it has a really strong vibe, you know.
Okay, Bita, let me clarify it from the very beginning.
Okay.
So So we have this story, which has got a very long history, you know what I mean? But ever since human beings have been brought into this world, there was this war between the heart and the mind.
Yeah.
So there are things your heart can see, but your mind cannot.
And vice versa.
And vice versa, of course. So there is this fight that you have to overcome it in yourself.
Exactly.
When you are alone, sitting by yourself and having some discussion with your own self, talking about something which is in favor of your heart, then your mind would come in the middle and be the one who's going to be the opposite side.
Exactly.
And the reverse, exactly. So there are some times that your mind is telling you something, but your heart does not actually...
I do agree with this part. But the thing is, you know, you shouldn't choose one of them. You have to make a balance between two.
Now, with this one, I agree.
Okay, thank you.
Vita, when you are stuck between these two, between your heart and between your mind.
You know, I don't want to talk like I'm a cliche or an ideal person.
Yeah.
I want to be myself. Actually, I think that there are, for example, different topics in this world, and you have to just recognize them and distinguish them. So
this is the difficult part. How to distinguish, how to make a balance.
It comes from experience. You have to experience other things. And I think one important aspect of this... topic is about our communication. You know, where you are in contact with other people, always there are some boundaries, there are some limitations that your mind is just trying to tell you that you have to consider them.
It's a reminder, always telling you what to do, what not to do.
All the people around the world just want to see other people as ideal as they want to. You know, we're searching for something like Medine Fazile or, you know, an
utopia.
Ideal Because of that, I think our heart, despite seeing all the discrimination, corruption, every bad thing in this world, they just want to consider it as something that is not really in this world, you know?
So you mean, as far as I got what you say that there are different things in this world. Some of them are ideal and our mind is trying to tell us about the ideal.
No, our heart is trying to tell us about the ideal.
Really?
You know,
I thought the otherwise. It's always the mind that is telling us about the
ideal.
Actually,
our heart, you know, deep in our heart and our soul, we're searching for something which is ideal. But, you know, somewhere deep in your brain, you know that being ideal, being perfect, you know, having no defect or something like that is impossible. It's impossible. You cannot be perfect because you're human and humanist were. And because of that, I'm telling you that we are not going to accept everything about this world. Just we're going to see everything we want to see. And this is about heart, not mind.
Well, I should disagree.
Why?
Again, this time I will disagree because it's always the mind that is taking us to the ideal. You know, the heart is free as a bird. So it would never tell you, you
maybe
have to be like...
Maybe your heart is free. You know what I'm telling you? You're a kind of a special individual in this world and you have your own characteristic person and something.
No, but trust me. It's this way for everyone.
No, not me.
All the people...
Not
that
me.
Okay, you are the exception.
Yeah.
See, exceptions do not break the rule.
I do agree with that.
All the people all around the world, let's say just it's in my personal opinion.
Yeah.
I would say that it's the mind that tells us that you should be perfect, you should be this or that. But then the heart is just like your sibling, is your partner in crime. It would take you wherever your mind does not really want you to go.
I do agree with what you're saying, but I think there is a misconception and misunderstanding here.
Yes.
You know what? I'm telling you that the power of seeing exists both in heart and mind. The thing is, heart just resists accepting the things that doesn't want to accept, you know?
Oh my God, it's the mind that is always resisting everything.
And, telling me like that? It's like we're talking about something which is kind of different, you know, I don't know, your mindset or something like that.
Of course, we're two different human beings.
Exactly.
But before we get into that, let's go for a break. What do you say?
I do agree with that one. After a break, we're going to continue our conversation.
Of course, let's take a sip of water and go for a short break. We'll be back in no time, so stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
We're talking about the long topic.
History of mind.
And heart.
Yeah, exactly.
The debate, the struggle, the fight.
Yeah, we're struggling and fighting about the point that, we're going to be ideal and we want these, which part of us want exactly this part? You know, it is our heart that persuade us to do this or our mind.
Yeah.
You are telling me that our mind is kind of more limited.
You see, the mind is the ruler. The mind is the ruler. Like you're in a school,
What is the heart if the mind
the
is the ruler?
The heart is the
soldier.
No. The heart is the one that I told you, always is slipping away. Always trying to fly like a bird, and you cannot put it in a cage.
Mm-hmm.
Putting it in a prison is going to hurt it, and then you would feel like broken. I don't know if you have ever recognized that. The logical people, those people who always side with their brain, they have some very tragic stories to tell.
Not all of them.
Most of them, let's say.
Okay, I do agree with that one. But it's not like you're telling that heart is something that bad that will be free.
I'm siding with heart.
I'm going to do whatever I want to do and I don't care about what your mind telling me.
Yeah.
It's not like that, actually. I mean, for example, sometimes you have to take risks.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be passionate about something.
Yeah.
And it's not about mind. It's about heart. This is what heart says in this life. You know, when you are really passionate about one thing, I don't mean just finding that thing is true or not. No, the thing I'm trying to tell you is that sometimes you want to do something, and this passion, this favor, is just
this
coming
feeling,
from
this
your heart.
Fondness.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the depth of our soul is really connected to our heart, and our heart is connected to our brain. You know, you cannot just completely distinguish them and tell me that, okay, our heart is like a bird that wants to fly. No. You know, maybe even our mind sometimes deep in his or her heart want to be a bird to that. A bird
you said heart, deep in her heart.
Yeah,
see?
Exactly.
See, we come to
so
the
So we cannot distinguish them. Do you agree with that part?
Yes, there is a difference between both of them, between the heart and the mind.
Exactly.
So let's come down from utopia and talk about real human beings and what happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
See, there is this heart and there is this mind.
Exactly.
We are put in the middle of this fight. So we are a kind of a tore apart in this battlefield. The heart is taking us somewhere and the mind is taking us completely the other way.
Okay.
So the thing in here is that sometimes in some situations, there's some certain things that the mind is trying to tell us, but the heart ignored to understand because it has been in a very special condition, like a patient who's going through a kind of sickness, and then they cannot have some special feelings. For example, when someone is madly in love with another person, their heart is going to get blind.
Exactly.
They cannot see, they cannot hear, they cannot use their logic, anything. It's only the heart that is taking them toward a direction that might not be very much having a happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. You know, in my life, you know, there is a rule that just tells me that follow your heart, but take your brain with you. at the same time, you know.
Yeah.
And also, as Imam Ali says, it's like there is no blessing better than your brain in this world.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you are blessed with brain and other creatures, you know, just don't have these blessing, you have to be different. You have to think different. And if you're going to just follow your heart, you just you'll act
this
in a way
which
is not appropriate
well, you
for
know,
your
have,
level of creation.
We have both of them, and we have to make use of them both.
Exactly. It's about balance.
Yeah, exactly.
If you agree with me.
Balance and moderation always would do the best in our life.
Exactly. And another thing which I want to tell you is that you have to purify your heart, first of all.
Exactly.
If, you know, your heart is something, some place which is full of sadness, full of sorrow, full of, I don't know, hatred and anything, it's not like you can tell me that it's hard. It's not hard. Heart is pure. And first of all, I think you have to follow your brain in the first place to find the, you know, the best level of your heart.
Yeah.
And then you can follow your heart, your passion, and everything in this life will taste differently.
Well, Bita, you know what? I think we have to come at peace with both of them.
Exactly.
We should come to a point in which the heart and the mind sit together and decide together, hand in hand, not ignoring one of them. Mm-hmm. Living with heart is going to be dangerous. Living with mind alone is going to be so boring.
Exactly.
So we should come to a conclusion that heart and mind are two of the most necessary part of our life.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't ignore one of them.
And also,
we have it in our narrations that logic is the criteria for every single thing.
Yeah.
So we should make use of that, though the heart is very important and we have to pay some attention to whatever she or he desires.
Exactly. You know, the thing is, both of them are important and you have to make a balance within these two. But you cannot always act as they are both the same.
Mm-hmm.
They are different. And sometimes you have to prefer one to another. And just try to be logical. And brain always shows you which is best for you. But heart is not always the best one.
Yeah, exactly. So we were talking about the fight between the heart and the mind. It's actually it has got a very long history, so we're not going to solve the world's dilemma in just 14
history,
minutes.
There are many artworks and portraits, everything about this matter. And even it was one of the main matters in philosophy in literature.
Yeah, exactly. But the main idea and the gist of it is that go for moderation. Make a bridge between both of them and try to find peace between both of them.
Balance is the key.
Yeah, balance is the key point in here. So thank you for listening.
I hope you're enjoying all of this conversation.
Yes, and until another session, we
farewell.
Bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.